Okay, I want to do a little bit of cleanup, I suppose. I think it was Craig that made the comment. We were talking about Son of Man in Ezekiel, and I think it was his footnote in his Bible that said Son of Man. It said Son of Adam. I never had really done any study on it, and so I went back and just looked what Hebrew was. Well, guess what? Adam is the Hebrew word for man. Of course, it's also the Hebrew word for Adam, and context determines. So anyway, I want to clean that up since that comment came up. Lynn brought a comment about Isaiah 63:1 and relationship to Genesis 49 that we were talking about at the time. And I think if you go to Isaiah 63, verses 1 through 6 in particular, what you'll find, this section, throughout Isaiah there are a number of messianic prophecies. This latter section of the book, I don't know, 60 or 61, through the end of the book, there is a view of the messianic kingdom, blessings that would be coming as a result. But this section in particular in Isaiah 63, if you take a look at it, deals with, I think, vengeance, judgment. And that's well and good. The point I was trying to make on Genesis 49, and we'll, depending on how far we get, we'll look at it either this tonight or next class, is the language in Isaiah in Genesis 49, 11, and 12 has to do with blessings. The scene is Israel is blessing his 12 sons. And when you see the kind of language that is used there, it's typical of the things you'll find associated with the kingdom, with the Messiah's rule throughout the Old Testament. He makes this, and the reason I say that, and I'll try to defend it in a moment, says he ties us back up. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet until Shiloh comes. And to him shall be the obedience of the people. He ties his foal to the vine and his donkey colt to the choice vine. He washes his garments in wine and his robes in the blood of grapes. His eyes are... The footnote in my Bible reads dull from wine. The footnote says darker than wine. And his teeth are whiter than milk. The idea I said at the time is this is a picture of abundance, or in our case, because I think spiritual abundance. Take a look, and the language is very similar to the kind of thing you'll find in other places. Take a look at Amos in the third chapter. I said Amos, I meant Joel. Joel, third chapter. Verse 18. Again, this is talking about the kingdom. It says, in that day the mountains will drip with sweet wine, the hills will flow with milk, and all the brooks of Judah will flow with water, and a spring will go out from the house of the Lord to water the valley of Shittim, and so forth and so on. You see similar kind of language over in Micah chapter 4, and we will recognize the first this section. And just start off in 4:1, you'll start to see what this writer is talking about. I want you to drop down to verse 4 of Micah 4. Each of them will sit under his vine and under his fig tree with no one to make them afraid, for the mouth of the Lord host has spoken. This picture of tying horse to the vine, or donkey to the vine, whichever it is, foal to the vine, to the choice vine, it's a picture. There's just so much abundance of stuff, of good stuff, to use my paraphrase, that the interpretation of that for us is one of, if it's speaking of the scepter not departing from Judah, the scepter of the tribe of Judah, talking about some future event, and it'll take time to decide what that is, and we'll talk about that later. But I believe it's the coming of the Messiah again, and this is the nature of his kingdom. It's going to be full of blessings. Okay? So, we got more on that. We'll hit it later. Raise your points later. Let's see if we can get through lesson two. We're studying the Son of God, we're studying the twofold nature of God, the nature of the Messiah. And one being the Son of God, and we looked at that, Jesus being one who claimed a unique relationship with the Father, claimed his equality with the Father. He claimed deity. He is deity. And all of this was confirmed by his signs, and a major sign of which was the resurrection, of course. And so then we got into talking about Son of Man. And the key thing about Jesus and being the Son of Man is he is a man. He lived on this earth as a man. God took human form. John 1:1. In the beginning, the Word was with the Word. In the beginning was the Word. I was going to start out Genesis 1. In the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God. The Word was God. Verse 14. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. So this human aspect of God among us. In Matthew 1:23, this section of Matthew is what the angel announcing to Joseph in a dream that Mary was going to give birth, and he shall be called Emmanuel, which means God with us. So Jesus is God, but he is God in human form, which then takes on some meaning to us as men and women. We have no trouble. I mean, you know, I don't think this crowd doesn't need to be convinced that Jesus was a man. He had the characteristics of a man. Things that come along with the flesh, body, with one exception. I mean, he was hungry, he was tired, he did all those things. But there's one thing he didn't do, and that is he did not sin. And the fact that he did not sin had a lot of importance to it, obviously. But in the fact that he lived on this earth, was tempted as we're tested, if you like, tempted, faced the same temptations we face, and yet he did not sin, then we have, and as Hebrews would say, we have a high priest that we can have confidence in. He understands what we went through. Did God understand what we go through? Does God understand what we go through without even having ever been on this earth? Of course he does. And so he didn't come here to go through all that so he'd understand from the experience. He came here, went on through all that. So we would have seen a man live on this earth without sin and give us that kind of confidence. The point made in Hebrews 2. Okay? Turn to Hebrews. I keep saying Hebrews 2. Turn to Hebrews 2. If you look at Psalms, and we won't, I hope you have, look at Psalms 8. What is Psalms 8 about? In a word? Now it takes a word or two. If you read Psalms 8, and you were a Jew, what would you understand out of Psalms 8?
God cared about me.
Dominion of man. Three words. Dominion of man. And that's a valid And you're a Jew. If I were a Jew at that time, that's what I'd walk away from it with. And it's not an invalid interpretation of that. However, as we see, and it's not unusual in prophecies are made, as we see, as fulfillment comes, Psalms 8 has a more significant meaning than simply the dominion of man in the sense, you and I have dominion, that is, that we have dominion over the animals, the land, and that kind of thing. So let's look at Hebrews 2, starting in verse 5. It says, "Be not subject to angels the world to come, concerning which we are speaking. But one has testified somewhere, saying," and then we get Psalms 8, or next word out of it. "What is man that you remember him, or the son of man that you are concerned about him? You have made him a little while lower than the angels. You have crowned him with glory and honor, and appointed him over the works of your hands. You have put all things in subjection under his feet. For subjecting all things to him, he left nothing that is not subject to him." I ask you some questions to try to lead you down this path. As you studied this, I will make a side comment. Psalms 8 is quoted, verse 8:2 is quoted in Matthew, 8:6 is quoted a couple of other times, 1 Corinthians 15 is quoted. It's quoted here, of course. And you could also say it's quoted in Ephesians, Ephesians 1:22. And these are all verse 6 that are quoted. And verse 6 having to be, "You have put all things in protection under his feet." I bring all that up to say this. Psalms 8, you see, quoted in the New Testament, applied to Christ, unless this is an exception, applied to Christ every time it is quoted. It's used to point out something about Christ. It's all things have been put under subjection to him. As you read this section in Hebrews, there is an argument being made. It's using this psalm to help point that out to the Hebrew writers. I ask you the question, here it is, the psalm says all things are under man's dominion. Is that true? It was not. What's not under man's dominion? What's not under our control? Death. We don't have death is not yet under our dominion. And so as the Hebrew writer is talking or writing, you see, and I didn't finish up on the last part of it. He says, "For in subjecting all things to him, he left nothing that is not subject to him. But now we do not yet see." We do not yet see all things. All things subjected to him. But what do we see?
We see Jesus.
So the human, I think the Hebrew writer, I think his point is that here is this prophecy. Our statement of fact, then which side of this argument you want to get on. That is, either this describes you and me, or it is a prophecy, or it's a dual play. His argument is, here it is, God said this. Now, let's test if that's true. And the way they test that, if that's true, as you read this section, he said, let's look at Jesus. What do we see with Jesus?
He was raised from the dead. He did overcome death, and he's overcome death for all of us.
Yes, he has, but do we yet have that dominion? Have we yet been able to overcome death?
No, but that's the promise, because he's been resurrected. We will.
Right. And that time's coming, but it hasn't come. But it has. Jesus makes the point. He has the keys of what? Revelation makes the point.
Death and Hades.
We know Jesus defeated Satan. And I think that's the Hebrew writer's point. Here is a man. Here is a man who has overcome death. whether or not this is looking forward as well to the fact that you and I will have dominion, or if this is focused strictly on Christ here, I think right here, his main argument is that Christ has done this as man. And I think our conclusion out of that is because he's done it for us, then he has guaranteed that that same thing will be before us at some point in time. When will that time come? 1 Corinthians 15. 24. There's an incident worth reading. 1 Corinthians 15. Get good. 24 makes this point. Then comes the end when he hands over the kingdom to God and the Father. When he has abolished all rule and all authority and power, he must reign until he's put all his enemies under his feet. The last enemy that will be abolished. Abolished is death. When will Psalms 8 be fulfilled for us? Then. Has Psalms 8 been fulfilled? Is that any prophecy? Yes. Sure has. In Christ. Okay, floor's open.
You know, there was a question among the Jews, not just among the Jews, but among others at that time. Obviously, Matthew 16, you know, some said he was, you know, Elijah and so forth. You had the Mount Transfiguration where Peter and the other disciples that were there wanted to build a tabernacle for Moses and for Elijah, as well as for Jesus. And then you had when John the Baptist had been beheaded, then Jesus was on the scene. There was some then that thought that that was John the Baptist who had come back alive. So I don't know how much of those kinds of questions were going in the minds of people when this Hebrew letter was written to the audience that it was written to. But certainly at some point in their history, there was confusion as to who this was. And this is one writing that would set the record straight as to who that was referred to, as who was God's, you know, Christ.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Are y'all lost, or y'all understand what I'm saying? I'm testing you. Mm-hmm. You can say you're lost, that's okay. The Hebrew, writer, I just might want to make a side comment. The Hebrew writer is particularly you're not a Jew, and I don't think anybody here in there is a Jew, can sometimes be, it makes excellent arguments, but you really got to get your head into, a little bit into the thinking process. I do, anyway, feel like I do, but into the thinking process of a Jew, best I can do, which is not always easy.
You know, he talks about what we don't see in verse 8, but then in verse 9 he talks about what we do see. We don't see the ultimate end of what he came for, and that is our own resurrection and eternal life. We don't see that. But we do see, this version starts out verse 9, but in contrast, we see him who for a little while was made lower than the angels, crowned with glory and honor because of the suffering and death, that he might taste death for everyone. So, we do see something.
Right. And look what he goes on. And look what he goes on to, oops, back there. Look what he goes on to say. Verse 14. Therefore, since the children share in flesh and blood, he himself likewise also partook of the same, that through death he might render powerless him who had the power of death, that is the devil, and might free those through fear of death were subject to slavery all their lives. For surely he does not give help to angels, but he gives help to the descendants of Abraham. Therefore he had to be made like his brethren in all things, so he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in things pertaining to God, to make propitiation for the sins of the people. So, you know, here's the outcome of that. Here's the product.
I think he's explaining just what he just said. And he didn't make the world to come for angels. He made it for man. And he crowned man with honor and glory. But we have hope from death, but we do see Jesus. And in verse 10, you know, says, you know, in bringing many sons to glory to perfect the author of salvation through suffering. And so it's, and then just what you read, it's both. It's man, it's not angels, it's people, it's sons of Abraham, it's sons of men, and their glory and their honor, and then what we're going to have.
I'm going to say this. I probably don't even say this, but we're going to, I'm not going to do anything with it. But when you read in Hebrews, in the first couple of chapters, about this world to come, I know where we will, at least my mind always used to go to, that's the world I'm in right now, as in physical world. I suggest to you, it's talking about the world to come, it's talking about the messianic rule, messianic kingdom. It isn't the world, and the reason they say to come is they're speaking from the perspective of the prophets as they were talking about this. Okay? So, I mean, that's all. I don't want to spend time on that. I just want you, as you do your study, think about that. Okay? Lesson number 3. You ready?
Lesson 4:5.
Yes. Yes.
Though man, he did not sin. And 1 Peter 2 brings that out quite well.
Yes.
But there's a passage in 2 Samuel 7:14 that to me is confusing. And of course, this is the promise,
right,
you know, the dual nature. But in verse 14, he says, I will be to them a father, and he shall be to me a son, and he commits iniquity, I will discipline him for rod and the stripes of the son. Obviously, we know he didn't commit iniquity. So, is this more of a reference to his bearing iniquity?
I don't think so. Some do. I think it's called, I think it's the issue of what was said here was said about Solomon. That it had a future beyond Solomon, it had a future application in terms of Jesus. So I think what he's talking about here is referring to Solomon. And there's no question that that David and Solomon took what was said and we'll cover this a little bit when we get to this part, but there's no question David and Solomon took these verses to mean that this kingdom would be Solomon's, and Solomon was to build a house. That's the way he takes it. And we'll see some scriptures to that effect. But we also know, based on later revelation, that this applies to the Messiah. And we also know that he didn't sin. So when I harmonize all that, I think what this is talking about, verse 14, is the sins of Solomon. And really subsequent, for that matter, men that would be on the throne. That's my answer. Some will take it to be the carrying the iniquity of mankind, and maybe it is. I'm not there yet. Okay? Genesis 3:15. We're going to hit some prophecies having to do with lineage of Christ. And these ought to be fairly straightforward. Linda and I had a conversation, and I think it's worth me helping clarify what I'm looking for here. When I put down a prophecy, and I've asked you to put down a fulfillment, don't think you have to go find where this is quoted in the New Testament. Things are fulfilled and not direct quotes of something that I may have over the left column. In a classic, a case in point, I'm jumping ahead, but Son of Shem. Well, you're not going to find Genesis 9:26-27, any part of that quoted in the New Testament, to my knowledge. But what you are going to find is the lineage of Christ tracing back to Shem. And so you can find, you know, the fulfillment of that would be, for example, Luke 3:36. Another fulfillment would be in Matthew, when the lineage of Christ is given. So I say that just for future reference. In the case of being born a woman, you see in Genesis 3:15, between your seed and her seed, specific to her seed. What's the fulfillment of this? What verse do you put down?
Like
Luke 1,
where it talks about
born of a woman.
Okay.
Well, I put 1 Corinthians 15, which is apparently a little off, because it talks about how Christ conquered death, which is what this is talking about.
Okay.
So that was a global answer, not a specific answer.
Mm-hmm. And I put 1 John 3:8 talking about him destroying the works of the devil.
Okay, let me tell you what the rules are. When it says born of woman, you know, big A, born of woman, that's probably what I'm looking for. Something has to do in that verse with born of woman.
Luke 1:31.
Okay.
But he doesn't say that on the... Nowhere does it say born of... Where? I would put any between you and the woman. That doesn't say anything about born of woman.
Your seed and her seed.
Yeah, that's entity between... Yes, that's why
her
I
seed.
You.
Well, that's what 1 Corinthians 15 talk about.
Alright, y'all gonna be play hard. Alright, be that way. Cut my lesson up. See you back here. I put down Galatians, I'll tell you what I put down, whether you like it or not. I put down Galatians 4:4. When the fullness of time came, God sent forth a son, born of a woman, born under the law. And we talk about it is significant that what you see, I think in Genesis 3:15, is this doesn't talk about, this wasn't a prophecy given to Adam, or wasn't a prophecy stated to Satan with respect to this one coming from the seed of Adam. It was from the seed of woman. And so that point is significant, I think, in Genesis 3:15. And of course, we'll see later the nature of the birth is clarified, more specific, at a later time. It deals with the virgin birth. But in this, I just wanted to review really Genesis 3:15, not beat it to death, but you see the nature of birth, you see in the language, the nature of birth, the nature of the implication there's going to be suffering and death. Death is hinted, death's not stated, obviously. And the fact that there'll be victory. It doesn't even, really, death is not particularly there, it's the idea of bruising his heel. There will be some sort of damage done. Yeah, Mike?
I thought the fulfillment would have been more in the gospel account. Where Galatians, and I got Galatians down, even though I didn't realize that's what you were looking for. I mean, that word fulfilled is just kind of out there by itself, and I'm reading the left side of the page, and I wasn't even seeing that so much. So, but, you know, I read Galatians 4 and 4.
Right.
But to me, that's a statement of the fulfillment. The fulfillment is actually in the gospel account, is the way I look at it.
Well, that'd be an overstatement for me. I've already said about everything pertaining to Jesus' life is in the gospel account, fulfilled in the gospel account. That's not exactly true. You have some other things. But remember, when the Holy Spirit guided the pens of the prophets and the apostles, what is being stated, like in Galatians 4, it is a statement of fact, but it's an inspired statement of fact. And for future reference, feel free to go other places if that makes the point. And that's all I'm trying to do is with this. And the answers aren't wrong. What I'm not trying to do is focus on the fact that whether it was in the actual occurrence or in the subsequent preaching of the apostles, teaching of the apostles and prophets, we can see where these things are tied back to Christ. In some cases, they have to be tied back to Christ for us. Okay? So, not in this case necessarily. Anyway, maybe after about the third or fourth try at this, we'll kind of, you'll kind of understand where I'm coming from. Don't know that you'll want to adhere to it, but at least you'll understand where my sense is.
So you were looking more for the born instead of...
Born of woman.
Of the enmity between...
Oh, yeah.
Born of a woman and
yes.
Satan.
Yes, yes. Yeah, we'll cover the other... Well, we'll cover that, but yes, born of woman. I'll say it again. When you see a title of it in big bold letters that says born of woman, you know, that don't be a kind of key to you. I'm sort of simple about that kind of stuff. But the point is, look, we're at the beginning of time. Genesis 3:15. Beginning of time. Who can fulfill this prophecy right then?
Any person.
Anybody. Except Adam and Eve. There's only two people have been eliminated. That's it. There's a lot of other people who can fulfill this.
Were they thinking Cain and Abel?
I don't think they're thinking anything. But, you know, well, I don't know what they're thinking. But as we go through time with this, what you find is we just keep narrowing things down. It's not a statistic, it's an estimate, that at the point in time of the first century, from this point in time to the first century when Christ was born, it's like 45 billion people had lived on the earth. Now it's probably 120 billion people. You know, if one wants to argue the Messiah hasn't come up to this point in time, there'd probably be 120 billion people in Canada. So it's one individual, let's take the first century, out of 40 plus billion people who lived over time. Right now, any of them could be that, could be the Messiah. And of course, subsequently, we'll see future prophecies will just keep narrowing this down, narrowing it down to one we know as Jesus. Okay? Alright, we did some good on that one. Genesis 9:26-27. I say prophecy, and you notice I made the point of prophecy of a lineage. Here's why I say that. And it may be that the problem is in the language. Get back there. You already read on my page. Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem, and let Canaan be a servant. May God enlarge Japheth and let him dwell in the tents of Shem. Actually, let him is not even in the original language. It is may God enlarge Japheth and dwell in the tents of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant. Here's the issue that people have argued about in this verse. Is it God that's going to dwell in the tents of Shem, or is it Japheth? And you can't win that. You can't get to the answer on that. Let's tell you right now, by the English, you can't get there by the Hebrew. You really can't get by the. You can't nail it down one way or the other. But it may very well, and I just presented here to say it may very well be this is the first prophecy, the only prophecy about Jesus being in the lineage of Shem. Now, when you get to chapter 11 of Genesis, you know, we see Abraham is in the lineage of Shem. So you know, in fact, that's going to be the way Jesus comes through this line. But whether or not this is a prophecy of that, I can't prove it or disprove it. And apparently nobody else can at this point. But what you do know is whether this prophecy is true or not, we know how Abraham got here. And so when you take the children of Noah, what have you got now? You've eliminated 2/3 of them. Okay? So now we've got rid of a bunch of people over here. It's no longer everybody. And that's the way it works. It just keeps narrowing down. Son of Abraham. In the question, I gave you a couple of prophecies here, and my question is, in what way is the Messiah the son of Abraham?
He's the son of promise through Isaac.
And
also faith. I mean, it was, of course, Christ being the epitome. I mean, he brought the faith.
I wouldn't call him son. I wouldn't call him faith.
We are the sons of Abraham by faith.
It's simpler than that.
He's a Jew.
He's lineage. Just natural lineage. Physical lineage. So these are the two ways he's a son. Messiah, yes. And these two prophecies describe really in you, describes that piece of it, and of course the blessing part of it would ultimately be fulfilled in terms of the coming of the Messiah and coming through a son that was to come, that is, Isaac, come to Abraham. So there's two ways in which that's true. Genesis 12, you can go to any, as far as physical lineage, you know, Matthew any of the Gospels that have lineages in them will tell you. Of course, Matthew 1:1 starts right off the bat with the fact that Jesus is the son of David, the son of Abraham. In Galatians 3:16, I put down. There are others you can put down about seeds of the nation, rather the in your seed all the nations will be blessed. But Galatians 3:16 is a key verse and an outstanding verse to go to in that. Okay. Genesis 12 provides. Really, Genesis 12. I like to think of it provides an outline of the rest of the Bible, because really from Genesis 12 on. You see the development of the coming of Jesus, the messianic fulfillment of the messianic promises that would come. You see the nation that was promised coming about. You see the land that was promised coming about. You see this blessing coming about. So you really have these three main factors that play out the rest of the Bible. The Old Testament, to a large extent, leading up to Jesus. Dealing with the land and the nation aspect of it, and then the preparing for the coming of Jesus through the Jewish people, through the Israelites.
So, the fulfillment and everything, like you say, in some of the sermons, like Peter's in Acts 3, he uses this very verse to show the Jews that this is Jesus, this is by whom they were going to be, that they are blessed. He uses that in Acts 3:25. When he's talking to the Jews.
Yeah, right.
So, I mean, you know, we see the apostles using the very quotes, you know, to prove that this is the Messiah. That this is who you are looking for. This is what this was talking about.
And you'll see that. You'll see that in, I think, more than one occasion, mm-hmm. Right? Going back to the promise, and this promise that was made to Abraham, I think there's six times it's made to Abraham himself. A couple times it's made to Isaac, and a couple of times it's made to Jacob as well. So it's a promise that was firmly implanted in the minds of the Jewish people as their history unfolded. Of course, the blessings were not only in Abraham but in the sea, what we're just now talking about. And excuse me. And there's a significance about Hebrews. Points out the significance of this promise in Hebrews 6 in terms of how God, the way that the Hebrew writer describes how God made the promise, and he made the promise by what? Anybody remember?
An oath.
With an oath.
swearing on himself. And it's impossible for God to lie. So there's just, you know, just the strength of the promise that was made. Of course, the Hebrew writer then talking about this blessings that come, the fact that what was being promised to Abraham was delivered in Jesus. And going back to the old law, departing from Jesus was a means of departing from the blessings of Jesus, and the blessings of that promise.
Lord,
yes.
On Genesis 12, you know, are the three promises to Abraham, they're still very vague. And at this point, Abraham has no idea of how God is going to do this. Mm-hmm. But when you get to chapter 15, God starts to explain it's not going to be another son. He's going to give him a son. Of course, Abraham doesn't understand that. He wants, you know, explanation on that. And then he tells him they're going to have a people that are going to go into a land that's not theirs, and they're going to be there 400 years. He's going to bring them out. Again, not a lot of detail, but he starts putting it together, I think, in the 15th chapter. It's like you said a minute ago, from Genesis 12 on, it starts to open up. But it's just a little bit of time in that detail.
And really, the adding to the detail about the messianic, about the Messiah, the coming of the Messiah, you know, that's going to happen all the way up to the Malachi. I mean, it's just going to keep on. Some of it will be repeats, but a lot of it will be new layers of information. I mean, we are out of time. We will pick up on Son of Isaac. Which says we will finish. We'll finish three. I'll try to have lessons four for you. That way. Thank you.